The CEOs of social media giants Facebook and Twitter defended their platform's work to fight misinformation as they were questioned at a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing yesterday. We're looking at efforts to fight disinformation networks in multiple countries that are spreading false or misleading information. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The social media companies have worked with U.S. law enforcement to dismantle foreign operations that target internet users in more than a dozen countries. Is disinformation a threat to democracies around the world? How do you think the U.S. should respond? We're at 800-642-1234. Nina Jankowicz is Disinformation Fellow at the Wilson Center Science and Technology Innovation Program. She wrote the book called How to Lose the Information War, Russia, Fake News, and the Future of Conflict. Nina, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Great to be with you.
Well, I know the term fake news tends to get under your skin a bit, although, you know, it is in the subtitle of your book. How should we label this problem, disinformation, misinformation, or fake news?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think we use those terms interchangeably, although they actually aren't interchangeable. So disinformation is the spread of false or misleading information with malign intent. That's, you know, when Russia or perhaps, you know, China, political operatives here in the United States use it for power or for profit. Misinformation is the same spread of false or misleading information, but without malign intent. So that's, you know, your crazy aunt or uncle at the Thanksgiving dinner table, though not this year, we hope, who's interested in conspiracy theories. Fake news is kind of a, you know, parlance that's come into popularity in political circles and also just colloquially, but it doesn't really hold a lot of meaning anymore because a lot of politicians all around the world, including President Trump, have used it to criticize reporting that they feel is either unfair or that is politically inconvenient for them. And so it's kind of lost a bit of meaning. But I would also say that most of the disinformation that is the most successful actually really isn't fake. It deals with real grievances in society. So calling it fake news is a bit of a misnomer.
It becomes more of a loaded term, if you will.
Yeah, exactly. And it's something that we've seen, again, authoritarians around the world use to criticize facts. And that's not where we want to be in a democracy.
Well, let's go around the world a bit here. Did Russians influence the 2020 election? And if so, how did tactics change from 2016?
Sure. So Russia continues to interfere in affairs around the world, both in the online sphere through online disinformation, as well as other influence campaigns through cultural and political vectors, economic influence. And we know that they continued to influence the 2020 election. The question that remains to be answered is whether those online influence campaigns had any effect. We know that the FBI and the NSA tipped off Facebook and Twitter to an ongoing campaign in September. It was called Peace Data, and it used fake profiles to contract with real American freelance journalists to write articles that targeted progressives in particular. That operation was taken down before it really got off the ground. But I think what we're seeing in general with the way that Russian disinformation has worked over the past couple of years, since it really came into greater awareness here in the States, is that rather than using huge networks of troll and bot accounts in order to amplify information and make it trend, make it go viral, what we're seeing is a bit more information laundering. So it's these narratives, like with this Peace Data operation, being planted in things like Facebook groups or WhatsApp messaging groups, where then authentic American voices are the ones that are amplifying and making things go viral, sharing it with their friends, right?
And that makes much harder to figure out where it's from or
precisely.
To trace it.
Yeah. And so we don't really know the extent of the foreign interference this year. It takes a little time to figure this stuff out. And certainly right now we have to take the social media platforms at their word for it, because we don't have any oversight or transparency mechanisms with them. But it does seem to have been mostly American disinformation this time around that affected our discourse.
We're talking with Nina Jankowicz, who's the Disinformation Fellow at the Wilson Center. You can join in. What do you think the state government needs to address address here in disinformation and the federal government. What have you seen on your social media feeds? And do you understand where it's coming from? What's missing? How you feel when you see that particular post? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. You know, you talk about information laundering and this kind of infiltration of different aspects of our society. How is disinformation harmful to individuals, but also then damaging for society as a whole?
Well, you know, Kate, I think this year, unfortunately, has been a case in point of the real world harms that online harms can cause. So we've been dealing, obviously, with the COVID-19 crisis and so much disinformation around vaccines, around the origin of the virus, around how the government is dealing with the virus. And that can be extremely harmful to public health. We've seen a couple of instances where people have really responded in confusing and alarming ways in order to try to protect themselves from the virus. But we've also seen people not heeding the public health advice that our government is putting out because they believe the virus is some sort of hoax. That's a real world harm. We've also seen, you know, false rumors circulating online about, let's go to the Pacific Northwest, for instance, where folks believed, quote unquote, Antifa had been starting the fires and were calling in alarm to their fire departments and diverting resources away from firefighting activities, calling in these bogus sightings, quote unquote, of Antifa. This stuff, again, has downstream harm, and that's in, you know, the public safety and public health sphere. But we also see disinformation having an effect on our democracy. I mean, right now, as this 2020 election that will not end continues to play out, we see just last night the president firing via tweet the nation's top cybersecurity official, the man who in most experts would agree is one of the guys responsible for keeping our election infrastructure secure, for making this the most secure election the United States has ever had. And he's been fired by tweet because he refused to amplify and agree with the president's assertions about how the democratic process in the United States is unfolding. And that has an effect on Americans' confidence in their votes and the infrastructure of our democracy. And that's going to last much longer beyond the 2020 election.
Circling back to COVID and what you've seen there as information spreads on a vaccine, you know, Dr. Anthony Fauci, the country's foremost infectious disease expert, has really been on the front lines here in talking with Americans about the pandemic and what to expect from a vaccine. When you see people like Fauci saying, I would take this vaccine, my family would take this vaccine, is that to counter some of this disinformation that's going on about vaccine trials?
Well, I can't speak to what's going on in Dr. Fauci's head, but certainly I think, you know, from what we've seen from other leaders around the world, this sort of modeling behavior is extraordinarily important, not only with things related to the vaccine, but things like wearing a mask also. Other world leaders are modeling that behavior, and we see an extreme reticence in the Trump administration to do that. And that leads to these conspiracy theories, these ideas, for instance, the allegation that a vaccine will have some sort of microchip so that the government can track you in it. There's no evidence for that. It's just completely made up, right? And we need our leaders to be coming on board with this vaccine because it's how we not only protect our families and their livelihoods, their well-being, but it's how we get the country back on track economically and in the sense of security as well.
Talking with Nina Jankowicz, disinformation fellow at the Wilson Center. She's talking about the deliberate and covert spreading of false information and what is going on with it and what's it doing to our world. What misinformation have you noticed surrounding the election, COVID, other issues? Where do you think it's coming from? Do you ever wonder if you're being targeted on social media and where your posts are coming from? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're discussing the proliferation of misinformation and disinformation here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. President Trump's refusal to concede the election and then layering on false claims that the election was rigged, that has opened up an ability for bad actors to exploit this moment in America. Bad information is spreading. Reporters are trying to trace and debunk false and misleading information that goes viral. And that is an uphill battle. Are you moving to a different social media platform since Facebook and Twitter have tried to clamp down on misinformation? Are you walking away and doing a social media detox? How is that going? 800-642-1234. Nina Jankowicz is Disinformation Fellow at the Wilson Center, and she's our guide for the hour. Let's bring in Jacob, who's joining us from DeForest. Hi, Jacob. What would you like to add?
Hi. I wanted to say that I think this problem is really important that people talk about it and think about it. So I want to say thank you first for taking the time to do so. And I was hoping that your guest could speak to how the disinformation and misinformation today is really of a unique character. I think a lot of people underestimate its impact because we're kind of used to, you know, CNN and Fox kind of lean one way or the other. And, you know, we're used to salesmen exaggerating things. And I think we're kind of normalizing it in that sense, and people are really underestimating its impact.
Underestimating its impact. What do you think there, Nina?
Well, thank you, Jacob, for that comment. And I totally agree with you. You know, I've gotten questions for people saying, you know, disinformation has always existed. What about the Trojan horse? You know, we went to war in the Spanish-American War based on disinformation. And what's different today is not only the speed at which information can travel, but the fact that social media platforms allow bad actors, whether foreign or domestic, to target their disinformation narratives to exactly the people that are going to be most vulnerable to them. Based on the tools that are available on social media, you can target a narrative based on somebody's zip code or even more granular geographically, their likes and dislikes, their age range, their gender, all these things to a very minute degree. And then you can test those narratives and figure out what resonates most with them. And that's something that Russia has done. It's certainly something that political operators here in the United States do. And I agree with Jacob in the fact that it's becoming normalized. You know, we used to have some sort of tacit agreement, right? That politics in general should be based on truths, and that democracy, when we go to the ballot box, is based on authoritative, trustworthy information. And what we're seeing today is not only the normalization of disinformation used in politics, but in governance as well, which has a huge downstream effect, as we were talking about before, on confidence in our democratic system. There was just a Reuters opinion poll that I saw during the break, which showed that President Trump's defiance of President-elect Biden's victory in both the popular vote and the Electoral College is affecting Americans' confidence in our democratic system, especially among Republicans. That's going to take a long time, again, to rebuild from. I've worked in countries like Ukraine, where there actually has been vote rigging in the past. And even after Ukraine has held, you know, clean, fair elections, people still have that worry that their vote isn't going to be counted fairly. And I don't want the United States to go that route. And that's what disinformation ultimately is doing. The ultimate victim is democracy. It's not a partisan issue.
From that historical framework, if you would, how are tactics today on social media different than what we saw during Cold War disinformation?
So a lot of the tactics are actually quite similar, seizing on those grievances, those fissures in societies, things like ethnic tensions or religious tensions. Here in the United States, one that Russia loves to use and weaponize is racism, because it is such a polarizing issue that people feel so strongly about. So using those tactics is definitely a common thread. It used to be a lot more difficult for bad actors to get those false narratives into the mainstream. It would have to be laundered from, you know, a fringe publication, and it would take a long time to get into the mainstream.
And there would now be like a printing press, if you want.
that's exactly right.
Billions of posts hitting platforms at once.
Yeah, and not only that, the infrastructure of social media means that the most engaging content online is often the most enraging content. So the platforms are basically incentivizing us to interact with bad information, which, you know, gives disinformers a lot more power. It makes it very easy to manipulate these platforms. And that's kind of what we were, which I hope we should have been talking about on Capitol Hill yesterday. Instead, we were talking about content moderation and censorship, but we should have been talking about the incentive structures that allow bad information to spread on social media platforms.
We're talking with Nina Jankowicz, who's disinformation fellow at the Wilson Center, getting her take on what she sees as disinformation spreads and that viewpoint from around the globe. 800-642-1234 to join in. Nina, you mentioned yesterday, as Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg and Twitter co-founder Jack Dorsey faced questions from the Senate Judiciary Committee, over 4 hours of questioning, more than 120 some questions that were lobbed at them. What were your biggest takeaways?
Well, unfortunately, Kate, these hearings about social media on Capitol Hill have been more about getting viral clips to share on social media, which is kind of ironic, than about oversight and making policy and getting policy answers. They've been dragging the tech executives. The senators have been dragging the tech executives up to Capitol Hill, this time virtually, albeit, to answer these very politically charged questions. And to my knowledge, no real policy has come of it. This has been mostly, again, to dunk on the tech executives, and they're asking questions that are politically motivated rather than motivated about protecting our democracy. I would love to see a real discussion, a fulsome discussion of what oversight of tech could look like, what the regulations that now I think tech companies are resigned are going to come down the pike very soon, what those should look like. But instead, we see that politically charged discussion with conservatives alleging that there is anti-conservative bias on the platforms. Yesterday, the Democrats were more interested in discussing, and I think this is a huge issue, but unfortunately, being that they are not in control of the committee, didn't get as many questions in about this. They're looking at how the platforms engender hate speech and things like that. But we really are not seeing that fulsome discussion that we need. And as a result, the United States is really far behind its peers in terms of thinking about how to regulate these platforms, but we have outsized influence because they're headquartered here. So mm-hmm. the regulations that we put forward are going to have ripple effects around the world. And instead, we're just kind of a bunch of, you know, rams butting heads against one another instead of making progress in this area. So I'm a little bit tired of these sorts of hearings, and I hope we see a change in their tenor in the next Congress.
Let's bring in Joe, who's joining us from Holman on social media. Joe, hi. What do you see?
Well, I just wanted to comment. I've noticed, even in my own social media, that a lot of people, fill out quizzes and play games and things that ask questions and volunteer, essentially, information to third-party apps. And then those apps sell that information to bad actors, nation states, or agents working for them to target these misinformation misinformation campaigns directly at the consumer, which is essentially individual voters. And in my view, from my experience and anecdotally, I guess, and I think from articles I've read, it appears that most of the time this targeted information, misinformation, is used to destabilize all the institutions of our government, anything from public health to voting, all across the spectrum. And they're actually starting to do it all over the world in any democratic country. And it's absolutely frightening, in my opinion.
Joe, thanks. Is that how Joe describes it, how this marketplace, if you will, of personal information works and gets passed along?
Yeah, Joe is very astute. So a lot of those third-party apps, at least in prior times on Facebook and things like that, used to take your data and be able to kind of abscond with the data. After the Cambridge Analytica scandal, which basically was using those types of quizzes and taking that data and selling it to third-party actors, political campaigns, nation states, et cetera, Facebook has since cracked down on that, or so they say. But that doesn't mean that they don't have this huge trove of data on each of us, right? They know how much time we're spending looking at posts, how much of videos we watch, what sorts of things we react to more frequently, and then they show us those things in our feed. So there's absolutely this huge amount of information that they use to target us through their advertising platforms, and that's available to anyone. All you need is a social media account. Sometimes you need a credit card with the advertising system, but as long as you're savvy about social media, you can use that targeting and that incentive structure on social media to seed these narratives. So I think the awareness that Joe has is really important, and we need to build that up in the American public, because people need to understand the trade that they're making, right? To use these platforms for free, you're essentially giving away a lot of information about yourself. And as long as we do that with awareness, we can navigate the information environment we're in a little bit more astutely.
Yeah, eyes wide open. Nina Jankowicz, disinformation fellow at the Wilson Center, researching the spread of false information racing around the internet. What policy action do you want to see from lawmakers to clamp down on this? What does enforcement look like for the tech industry? Join in 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up after a news update on the Ideas Network. We're spending the hour on conspiracy theories and disinformation on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The CEOs of social media platforms Twitter and Facebook faced questioning from Senate Judiciary Committee members yesterday. They were asked 127 questions for more than 4 hours, tallying there by the New York Times. Republicans honed in on how the platforms could employ less moderation. Democrats asked dozens of questions about misinformation. Do you want to see more or less regulation of the tech industry? How would you grade how the platforms do in moderating the billions of pieces of content posted to their platforms? It's 800-642-1234. Nina Jankowicz is disinformation fellow at the Wilson Center, and she's our guide. Nina, we heard from David, called in from Milwaukee, couldn't stay with us. And David thinks the issue with information gets to and how it gets to the public goes back to the 80s. When President Reagan repealed the Fairness Doctrine, which provided licensing requirements for radio and television stations, and it required opposing viewpoints and coverage of, you know, controversial issues. What does the Fairness Doctrine have to do with this?
Wow. Your listeners are extremely astute and aware.
Yes,
I think
they are.
Wisconsin should probably lead our misinformation fight if this is how everybody there is. The Fairness Doctrine took away some standards for broadcast media about what you could say and do. And that had essentially led to the rise of Fox News, which some scholars, media scholars in the space who study disinformation, say is the most exigent threat to our information environment right now. And it is the thing, it is the oxygen that keeps a lot of the domestic disinformation that we're seeing going. And certainly, you know, foreign actors look at things that are happening on Fox and in other media, especially online fringe media, and they that's how they decide on narratives, right? It's not like they're making stuff up, as we talked about at the top of the hour. They're looking at things that Americans are already talking about and perhaps presenting them in a misleading or kind of vitriolic way. And that leaves us more vulnerable to manipulation, both from within the country and outside the country. So a lot of our peers, you know, the UK, for instance, have standards that broadcast media need to adhere to in order to maintain their licenses. And a lot of our peers think it's very strange that the United States doesn't have that. But with our attachment to the First Amendment, as it should be, that's something that makes us very uniquely American. It's something that other countries, you know, admire and look up to. It's hard to reconcile how some sort of broadcast regulator or indeed an internet regulator would make decisions about what can and cannot be said on air or shared online.
Let's bring in Bill in River Falls on the fairness doctrine issue. Bill, hi. What would you like to add?
Yeah. Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Very similar, but I'm wondering about the financial incentives and to bring back these regulatories, the carrot and the stick. You talked about Britain doing that. And it really, you know, this notion of the fairness doctrine, getting back to a common set of facts, because right now we're creating a division in such that a certain portion of the population refuses to believe in fundamentals like gravity and like, is water wet? And it's very hard to bring up public discourse and talk about the policy changes you've talked about when some people will have the concept that the fact is a circle is square. And as long as we're in that paradigm of Orwellian newspeak, I don't know how you can come back to the things you talked about that are very reasonable policy changes, very reasonable regulation changes. And unless we get back to some sort of fairness in the information, transparency in the information that's out there, because this, the echo chamber of lies is not going to get us there. History is replete with ignoring facts. Ask the captain of the Titanic if you could.
Bill, thank you. Wow. Yeah, Nina, go ahead.
Yeah, so I agree. I mean, I think we do need to set those incentives. The problem is this sort of ignorance of the facts and normalization of disinformation has also infected our policymakers in Capitol Hill. As we just saw last night, not to, you know, beat a dead horse, but the president firing nonpartisan officials who are tasked with protecting the nation's elections and the nation's discourse around elections. And I need to check this morning, but last night we only saw a few tepid responses from Republicans about that issue. And that shouldn't be something that, again, is a partisan issue. So I'm hoping that in the next administration, given President-elect Biden's, you know, bipartisan bona fides, he'll be able to build those bridges and really kind of bring us back to a standard of facts and truth so that we can set those regulations and financial incentives for not only the social media platforms, but perhaps broadcast media as well, to adhere to a common set of facts and protect our democratic discourse, to make sure that everybody has an equitable voice and that the facts are being reported in order to support our democracy.
On the issue of tweets and the president's tweets, Saul in Stevens Point would like to add to that. Saul, hi.
Yeah, hi, good morning. Terrific guest. A lot of the problem with misinformation has to do with the infatuation of our conventional media with social media. And I include the New York Times and the Washington Post and the broadcast news networks. Twitter, in terms of its reliability, is gossip. It's not reliable news. And I blame much of this faith in social media disinformation to the major news media. They've allowed the president to govern by his Twitter feed. And if you looked at the New York Times, they had whole columns devoted to what he said on Twitter. Instead of demanding that the president present policy statements from the White House press office, take a look at Biden. He's always got a big sign behind him. It says President-elect Biden. So I think the major media are largely are very much to blame for this easy disinformation
in reporting on the tweets. Nina.
Yeah, I think the media have become a little bit more circumspect since 2016. We've seen changes in reporting and verification that probably should have happened a long time ago, rather than, you know, reporting on what users who may or may not exist are saying online. They have we've seen, you know, a reticence to do that in this election cycle. And certainly, especially since November 3rd, a little bit more introspection about amplifying the president's claims. And I do agree that we, in some ways, the media have kind of given President Trump due that he does not always deserve. Yes, he is the president of the United States. there is a public interest into reporting about his you know, ideas and his behavior. But it doesn't need to be part of that 24-hour news cycle. And to some extent, you know, the mainstream media are content curators, right? That's the role that they have always played. So the editorial decision making needs to kind of reflect our current environment and the way things are moving, and you know, deciding for readers, for listeners, for viewers, is it really important that we report on this right now, or is it just going to drive our ratings up and get us more ad revenue? And that's something that the social media platforms have to consider as well. And certainly their economic incentives are also out of whack. So it's all part of one holistic system. And I'm hoping after these 4 years, we're already starting to see some introspection. Hopefully we'll see even more and a return to slower news in the coming years.
Nina Jankowicz, disinformation fellow at the Wilson Center, our guide this hour on the spread of bad information. How do you think the U.S. should respond to disinformation and spread by Russia, other countries, other actors? What about the issues of misinformation and disinformation that are domestic here in the U.S.? Join in with your thoughts, your insights, 800-642-1234. Bert is joining us from Stevens Point. Hi, Bert.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you for having me on and bringing this topic up. I think it's huge. My biggest thing is obviously media can't control disinformation. And so I believe that we need to keep our leaders to honesty. Like they in my thoughts, they should not have amendment rights. Once they're an elected official, they shouldn't have the right to just lie or say whatever, you know, feeds their interest. And I guess I'm wondering why we can't hold them to some point of honesty. Like I understand, like, they're always going to have mistruths or, you know, two points of views, but not outright lies like we've had in the last 4 years.
Yeah, so Bert is wondering, why can't there be standards of accountability here, Nina?
So there are some standards, at least on the floor of Congress. There are, you know, limits to what congressional representatives can say when they're in Congress. They can be censured if they break those rules. The other limit, I would say, and this gets back to, you know, the power of democracy, is the ballot box, right? Americans need to exercise their democratic rights, their civic duty, and reject the what they're seeing in terms of rhetoric that they don't like. Now, it's another question entirely how we bring along the folks who have either who agree with those lies or are taken in by those lies, or the folks who forgive those lies because they are looking to achieve a certain policy solution. And I think that gets to media and digital literacy, which we've really not talked about at all this hour yet, something mm-hmm. that I'm very passionate about, and also civics, making sure that Americans understand how the system works and how it's supposed to work for them and their role in it. Ultimately, the most powerful thing in our democracy is our vote.
Nina Jankowicz, disinformation fellow at the Wilson Center, as we discuss the spread of false, misleading information this day and age and what can be done to rein it in. Are you interested in fact-checking from organizations like Snopes or PolitiFact? Does that do any good to seek out the truth? Are you worried your loved ones are falling prey to bad information? How do you intervene? What are those conversations like, especially around the upcoming holiday season? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with Wilson Center disinformation fellow Nina Jankowicz, talking about how misinformation and disinformation spread and affect our society and where do we go from here. Nina stays with us for 10 more minutes. Sherry is joining us from Madison with thoughts on what we can do education-wise. Sherry, hi.
Hi. Yes. I'd really like to see more education in especially high schools, maybe, on how to discern what would be fake news or what would be misinformation or disinformation, and how, and to teach them how to search it out for themselves. My brother is very into watching Fox News, and he has been targeted on Facebook with a lot of truly false information, most of which he has passed on to me. And I've spent time fact-checking and getting back to him. But a lot of times it just angers him because he thinks I'm part of the conspiracy then. But like the latest one was he sent one on the vote in Clark County, Nevada, saying that 315,000 votes had been thrown out because they were all wrong. They were, illegal votes. And so I did a little searching and found out there were only 315,000 votes total in Clark County, Nevada. And so it's like, oh, they threw out all the votes in Clark County, Nevada. I think those people would be really upset.
That wouldn't work. Yeah. Sherry, thank you for bringing that piece here. And I know that, Nina, you're trying to get at that as well. What can we do education-wise?
Yeah, so I think this is something that we've really kind of ignored over the past couple of years. You know, everyone pays a lot of lip service to media literacy, digital literacy. They nod and say, yes, this is a good thing, but we haven't seen any investments in it. And again, I don't think this should be a partisan issue. We should want our voters to be able to navigate the information environment to make better decisions that are in their interests. So I'm hoping to see the federal government empower the Department of Education to set a curriculum that states can sign up to teach, you know, media literacy and digital literacy education in our schools. But I also think it's incredibly important that we try to reach voting age populations. And one way that we can do this is through our network of really great libraries in the United States. Librarians and libraries are among the most trusted institutions that we have across political lines. They can be doing this sort of training. They're looking for a new raison d'etre in the 21st century. And I think that's a great way in every community practically in the United States to deliver that training. And then on Sherry's point with fact checking and our relatives, I know this can be, you know, something that is an incredibly difficult and charged thing to do. And the psychological research shows that it's best to do this on a personal level. So rather than, you know, commenting on a Facebook post or responding to somebody publicly, even if they're, you know, a relative or good friend, the best thing to do is reach out to them privately and then try to have a conversation rather than just, you know, sending a fact-checking link or something like that. It takes a lot longer, of course, but asking them, I saw you shared this piece. What about that interested you? And see what might be motivating them to seek out that information in the first place and offer them an alternative down the road. But again, doing that in a private setting often makes sure that people don't dig in their heels right away and leads to a more productive conversation.
How does our own confirmation bias fold into this and make us decide what we believe and don't believe?
I think that has to do a little bit with media diet. So we are more likely to seek out information that aligns with our worldview. And I think it's important that rather than just gorging ourselves on one particular media source, that we seek out a variety of different sources so that we understand what perhaps the other side is saying, what their concerns are, and understand better how to respond to it. So rather, again, than gorging ourselves, just eating a little bit at a buffet or maybe tapas style, if you will, to make sure that we have a more holistic worldview of how these discussions are being had all around the country. I think that's extremely important, but it also plays into our social media confirmation bias. You've probably heard the term filter bubble. The algorithms show us generally the things that we want to see that we're going to interact with. And that's not necessarily only things politically. It might be that you're really into cute cat videos. Then the algorithms are going to show you more about that. So we really need to make an effort of healthy information consumption, going beyond what's just being fed to us and trying to seek out other points of view.
Talking with Nina Jankowicz, Disinformation Fellow at the Wilson Center, for a few more minutes this hour. Mike is with us in Ithaca, New York. Hi, Mike. What would you like to add?
Hey, good morning. Thanks for the call. So I was wondering if you've done any research on the demographics, which segments of our society are more prone to believe this disinformation and misinformation. Thanks.
Thanks, Mike. Yes, so I haven't done the research myself, but there are plenty of researchers who have looked at this. They do find that older adults are more likely to engage with dis and misinformation. And the thought there is that it's because older adults are used to having the mainstream media act as kind of gatekeepers or content curators. And so what they're seeing on their social media feeds in particular, they're treating the same way as they used to treat, you know, reading a newspaper. So that's why I think it's extremely important that we reach out to all ages when we're doing this media and digital literacy training. There's also some research. I will name check my colleague, Dr. Dana Young, who's at the University of Delaware. She's looked at the kind of emotional responses behind dis and misinformation and what motivates different political parties. And in general, she's found that conservatives tend to be motivated by outrage, and liberals tend to be more motivated by humor. And that's why we see some of kind of the humorous TV and radio shows related to the news on the left, and the stuff that we see on the right on talk radio, for instance, or even some of the shows on things like Fox are motivated by that outrage. She's got a great book called Irony and Outrage that looks at this. But in general, we do see that there is more dis and misinformation traveling on the right. And it's because not only of that incentive for outrage, but also the outrage that the social media platforms incentivize. Generally, we see, you know, the highest shared articles on Facebook, the most engaged with ones, are ones that are coming from the right. And that's because that incentive structure really does benefit that enraging information.
Well, before we get to closing thoughts here on where we go from here, I want to do a quick sweep around the world. Is there any direct evidence that China is targeting our media channels or Iran?
Yeah, so we've seen campaigns both in the cyber and hacking sphere from all three, Russia, China, and Iran, during this election sphere or election cycle. We've also seen China using overt means of propaganda to try to influence the United States. But I think because we recognize that they're coming from Chinese accounts, people are less likely to take them on board. Iran, of course, very famously before the election, tried to spoof emails from the far right Proud Boys group into intimidating Democrats not to show up to vote, but the Cyber and Infrastructure Security Agency at DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, found that out and quickly cracked down on that scheme. So the playbook for online influence is open, and I think we all need to be extremely aware that it's folks not only here in the United States that are using it, but many of our adversaries around the world see this as an opening to asymmetric influence over the United States, where they might not be able to compete economically or militarily. They feel that they can sow this discord in our society, and we all need to be on guard about that.
Nina, in the last few seconds here, what actions can we take today, right now, to make a difference to stop this?
The most important thing that we can do is recognize that disinformation runs on emotion. So if you see a piece of content, whether that is in traditional media or on social media, if you feel yourself getting emotional, you can practice informational distancing the same way we're practicing social distancing. That's a good indication when you're getting emotional that you should walk away from your device for a little bit. We are the ones that amplify this content generally. Even, you know, with the Russian Internet Research Agency in 2016, the most successful content was stuff that got shared organically by authentic American voices. So think before you share, think about, you know, why somebody might have it in it to manipulate you, and just practice some good digital hygiene.
Nina, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Nina Jankowicz is Disinformation Fellow at the Wilson Center and author of the book How to Lose the Information War. Just ahead, it is 1A. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.